You're listening to Noel Debien on Sunday nights.
Good to be with you. Coming up in this hour, a little later, The Maker of Gaby Baby. Now, it's a film about family life in same-sex couples. She'll be joining us a bit later. You've probably heard about it all. It got banned from Burwood Girls High School and from all state schools during school hours. It had to be shown after hours, if at all. And for a film, it's gotten more media coverage in New South Wales and Victoria in particular than many blockbusters. And it won't be only Maya Newell, the filmmaker, who happens to be an old girl of Burwood High School, but also Shane Mallard. Now, Shane is a member of the Legislative Council in New South Wales. He gave a very strong speech in New South Wales Parliament earlier this week, criticising the way the Daily Telegraph beat the story up into some sort of gay and lesbian political putsch into schools. That's coming up a little later. But first, you may or may not have been keeping your eye on the Royal Commission into Sexual Abuse. But on Monday last week, there was some pretty important testimony given. You probably heard the bishop's opinion about Cardinal Pell, that he broke the unity of the Australian Catholic bishops' response. Those were the headlines. But retired Catholic Bishop Geoffrey Robinson, who led the church's response to sexual abuse right up until 2004, gave much more significant testimony than that. It wasn't just the headlines, and the media seems to have largely ignored it. He had gotten an earlier hearing last week because he has terminal cancer. Now, there are not only his words during that whole day of testimony, but the documents tabled in evidence, which are quite important in understanding how Australian Catholic leaders had one arm literally tied behind their back the whole time they were trying to deal with this problem, by the Vatican. And more importantly, there's a letter there dated 2013 that shows that they still do. In 2015, right now. These matters caught the eye of our special guest for the beginning of this hour, Kieran Tapsell. Kieran's a lawyer and the author of a book called Potiphar's Wife. It's about the deep secrecy surrounding sexual abuse in church circles, called the Pontifical Secret. Kieran Tapsell, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Noel.
Kieran, I couldn't help noticing that Geoffrey Robinson's testimony seemed to be explaining that the main problem was the Vatican. Am I getting it right?
That's exactly right. And in fact, that was extremely refreshing because what he said was, whatever the great faults of the Australian bishops have been over the last 30 years, it still remains true that the major obstacle to a better response from the church has been the Vatican. What we've seen in Australia is the bishops copying what Benedict XVI did in his response to the Murphy Commission. He completely ignored all the problems of canon law, and he blamed the bishops for not following the well-established norms of canon law.
Now, let's just say for the listener, the Murphy Commission was the commission looking at the Irish situation, which was quite disastrous, and the Pope was warning bishops to keep following canon law. And the point that we're about to discuss is that canon law was in conflict with civil law.
In Ireland it was. Certainly it was at the time of a letter of 1997 by the prefect of the Congregation for Clergy, Cardinal Castrillon, when he told them to disobey civil law.
Part of this was to do with canon law reserving all cases of clergy for judgment by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. This is the key here, isn't it?
Yes, look, we have to keep two things separate. There's one about reporting. It's quite a different issue to what we might call the disciplining of priests.
Yes. The issue here, though, is, of course, that if you read the canons, that any disciplining of a priest is reserved to the Holy See, to the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. Effectively, it goes straight to the Pope.
That's right.
And the situation which Geoffrey Robinson was testifying to was that the hands of Australian bishops were effectively tied unless it had been first reported to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith mounted a trial and found the priest guilty, and then it would advise the bishops what they could do. That's what it said, effectively, isn't it?
Yes, but you've got to look at different times. That's after 2001.
Yep.
After 2001, it would be a preliminary inquiry in the local area, but it may not. It may be done by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And then the matter referred on to that congregation, and then they would instruct the bishop what to do. Now, what they might instruct him to do was to conduct a judicial trial. They might instruct him to do what they call an administrative procedure, or they might simply decide themselves to reserve it to themselves and impose some sort of penalty, which may be dismissal, but it may not be.
Mm. A case that Bishop Robbins mentioned was the John Nestor case. Now, Nestor was stood down, and then his subsequent bishop, Peter Ingham, discovered that Nestor had appealed to Rome, and Rome told the bishop to give him a job, and then the bishop refused.
Yes, and this is one of the problems which Jeff Robinson mentioned. What he was basically saying is, when he looked at canon law in 1996, when he was appointed, he decided it was hopeless. It was never going to deal, for a whole variety of reasons, with the problem of sexual abuse. The most obvious problem was there was a five-year limitation period, which was imposed by Pope John XXIII in 1983.
Which meant most cases would never come to trial under church law.
I can't remember the exact figure, but there's a document which was produced to the commission where they actually looked at how many cases could proceed because it was within the limitation period. It was something, you know, 2 or 3%. So you're talking about children here. If a child was abused at the age of 7, he or she had to complain about it at the time they were 12. If they got to the age of 13 and decided to complain, the crime disappeared.
Under the canons.
Under the canon. There was no limitation period until 1983. Why do they need one at all? You're talking about serious criminal offences.
Well, let's leave that aside just for a moment, because I'd like to talk about 2015.
Yes.
Because the thing that struck me on Tuesday when I looked at this was I went down the list of things that had been put into evidence. And there is a letter there, which I wonder if you noticed, effectively from the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith to Dennis Hart, the Archbishop of Melbourne, but also the President of the Catholic Bishops' Conference. So it's a letter effectively reminding all bishops. And it tells the bishops that all cases of disciplining clergy are reserved to Rome. This is 2013.
Yes, that's right. And the interesting thing about that letter is there doesn't seem to have been a reply which was tendered at the commission.
Well, the strange thing to me also is, though, that the letter seems to be saying that bishops have no power to stand down priests without the approval of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith.
No, I don't think it says that. I think it does say that they can stand them down pending the determination of the allegation.
But as I understand it, if you read Canon 1722, there has to be a judicial process already begun for that to come into effect. Is that not the case?
Yeah, but look, that was changed in 2010.
Right.
That was one of the problems. That's true under that canon. You actually had to have effectively a penal trial started before you could stand someone down. But in 2010, when an allegation is made and a preliminary inquiry has to start, then the accused can be stood down pending a decision. Now, that's the way our civil society works.
Yes.
The big problem really is that when something is then referred to the CDF, they then instruct the bishop what to do. But ultimately, what actually happens to that priest will really be determined by the CDF in Rome, by the Congregation of the Doctrine
of the Faith. Not by the local bishop.
Not by the local bishop.
Geoffrey Robinson, though, raised a particular matter in the Nestor case. He said that when Bishop Peter Ingham declined to give him a job, said, look, in conscience, I can't do it, I'm not going to do it, Bishop Ingham was risking penalties himself because of the way the CDF regulates this and the way canon law regulates this.
Yeah, that's true, but you see, all of that arose out of the problem that Towards Healing, according to the Congregation for the Clergy, didn't comply with canon law. And as Jeff Robertson said, we had to go and do something else because canon law was hopeless for a whole variety of reasons.
And he's a canon lawyer, by the way.
And he's a canon lawyer, was professor of canon law.
Yep.
One of the problems was what they called administrative leave.
Mm-hmm.
You quite rightly mentioned that before someone could be stood down, there had to be a preliminary inquiry and then there had to be a penal trial. But really, all canon lawyers accepted that wasn't permitted under canon law. I mean, that was an awful situation because it meant that priests would be staying in their parishes while these allegations were being heard. Now, that has been fixed up since 2010, so they could be stood down. But the big problem with the Nestor case and Bishop Ingham was that they had started the proceedings under Towards Healing.
So they were following the Australian standard that Geoffrey had championed?
That's right,
yep.
Which was set up under Towards Healing. he was stood down. Mestre appealed to Rome, and Rome said, no, you can't do that. Reinstate him.
Meaning towards healing can't work if a priest appeals against it.
Absolutely. You can't have a local protocol which conflicts with canon law. You could have all bishops agreeing, for example, as they did do, to adopt the principles of towards healing. Apart from Cardinal or Archbishop Pell, as he then was in Melbourne, this relied on the goodwill of the bishops. That agreement was not enforceable in canon law or in civil law.
So it relied on their agreement and their continuing agreement.
And their continuing agreement. At any time they could say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Well, I read that letter that I referred to you from 2013, and it instructs bishops to remember and to be aware that they cannot discipline clergy without directions from the CDF. And it strikes me that there could already be bishops after 2013 who are obeying that canon strictly and doing exactly what Rome wanted, and that would be in conflict with towards healing.
They can use what they call disciplinary measures against them. They can remove priest faculties, for example. They can say, well, you can't say mass publicly and all this sort of thing.
Yep.
What they cannot do is they cannot apply a permanent suspension effectively stopping the priest from practicing as a priest without going through a procedure involving Rome.
You could read this to say that Jeff Robinson managed to set up a system called Towards Healing just with the agreement of the Australian bishops, that it went beyond what canon law could do, and in fact he admits it was in conflict with canon law, and that once he was gone, without him driving it, who's to hold it together?
Even if he stayed on, I don't think he could have held it together anyway. You've got to give him full marks for trying.
Mm.
And he did say in the initial stages it was successful because no one challenged it. The trouble is, once someone challenges it, I mean, word gets around, doesn't it?
The thing that also sticks in my mind as I'm trying to analyse this and put it all together is that Father Brian Lucas and Father John Usher were literally experts at getting priests to resign voluntarily to stand down.
Sure.
They were very good at it.
Sure.
But they were doing it because they pretty much didn't have another option canonically, did they, without a judicial trial?
I mean, really, Jeff Robinson criticised quite harshly Pope John Paul II, but he made it impossible to get rid of a priest. You had the extraordinary situation like down in Victoria where I think it was Bishop Mulkerns and Bishop Connors went to visit a priest who had been convicted 4 times and was in jail. And they asked him, please, would you sign a voluntary laicization?
A voluntary laicization. They could not impose
it. They could not impose it. And in many cases, these priests refused because at the same time, under canon law, the bishops were obliged to keep them on the payroll.
Mm. So there was income.
So there was income.
In summary, it looks to me that what Bishop Robinson has done on Monday, together with the documents that have been tabled, suggests that over the whole period he was working from, what, 84 right through to 2004, even though there were changes, there was a continuing conflict between canon law and what the bishops were trying to achieve within civil law, particularly with the disciplining of priests in particular. And this has been ongoing and changing. And the 2013 letter confirms that there is still a conflict, it seems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is going to be one of the big challenges for the Royal Commission, because its terms of reference are to look into systemic issues. Now, there is nothing more systemic than law, whether it's canon law or civil law. And here you have a situation where effectively a foreign government is saying, we will decide, in the case of clerics, whether or not they can stay clerics or not. This has a potential of creating an enormous conflict between church and state. I think what's going to happen is the state says, well, we don't care. We will decide whether we will be a priest or not. I think that's inevitable.